Welcome to the Wampa's Lair Podcast. Deep in the bowels of the frozen ice caverns of Hoth, our hosts, Carl Eclair and Jason Hunt, discuss all things Star Wars. So join the conversation and hang out here in the Wampa's Lair.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Wampa's Lair Podcast. This is episode number 221, Planet Telling, Part 2. So listen to the first part. I am, as always, one of your hosts, Jason Hunt, and with me, the Bantha to my Tauntaun. We have Carl Eclair.
Is this because I'm getting fat?
No, I just can make the Tauntaun noise, so I had to be the Tauntaun.
That makes sense. I do like that you can do the Tauntaun sound. Bantha's just kind of like, they don't make much of a sound, do they? They do. Yeah. There you go. Challenge accepted by Jason. I'm excited to talk some more planets. I had so much fun with that first part. Talking all the planets from the prequels and how they, you know, act as storytelling elements. And that's exactly what we're going to be doing again with this particular episode, is continuing into the original saga. We're going to look at all the planets from the original films and how each of those planets in their settings act as storytelling elements for each of these films. So,
yes.
Like Jason said, if you missed the first part, it doesn't matter. You can still listen to this one, but I would recommend going back and checking out part one as well, if you're interested in the prequel planets.
It was a lot of fun, so I had a blast. I'm really excited about tonight's episode. So.
Yes, I am as well. And for once, finally, we are set to do a matchup that we've put off for a little bit because we kept forgetting to share it on social media, but we got that taken care of. And we have a matchup of Director Krennic and Padme Amidala in a blaster showdown. And we got quite a bit of feedback once again, which was great to have back, have all the Larian input back at it again. Jason, what did they say?
Well, on Facebook, Travis Magruder says that he'll make no effort to look past his bias and chooses Padme. Damian Krasinski says Director Krennic because he will deploy the garrison. Buradori MacArthur says Padme may outmaneuver Krennic, but the Death Troopers appear and protect him, so he gives it a tie. Actually, I think I gave that to Krennic in that one. So, Jesse Collins says Krennic because he'd do anything to please his emperor. And his first name is Orson, which sounds like awesome, so it's Awesome Krennic. I love the reasoning from Marlarian sometimes. Ian Statsny gives it to Padme because she's a better shot. Jeffrey Fishbach also goes with Padme. Bobby Gordon gives it to Krennic. Thinks Krennic would come out on top, but wouldn't realize he'd been fighting one of the handmaidens. This one's a decoy. So we'll call it a tie. Thomas Davis says Krennic, because he's tougher. He was killed by the Death Star. Padme was killed by a broken heart. Jeffrey Beaumont gives it to Krennic. Travis Fritsch gives it to Padme, using a decoy. William Wilson, who I think is a new responder to our matchups here, gives it to
Padme. Welcome. Well, welcome, William.
There you go. That's our welcome introduction. I hope we didn't scare you away, William. William gives it to Padme. She seems to have more experience when it comes to using weapons. Krennic never kills anybody that we see, and Padme survived all these sort of things, such as invasion by the droid army, Colosseum fight against angry predators, and so on and so forth. Patrick Kotev gives it to Padme. Zach Jenko gives it to Padme. Paul Gann says, after a day of aggressive negotiations, Padme finally calls Anakin for help, and despite the Death Trooper's best efforts, Krennic finally chokes on his own aspirations. Adam J. Taylor gives it to Padme because she calls her security. Panaka!
Panaka! Red Panaka. Group, blue group, everybody this way!
Buddy Kyle Avery, Kyle Baca, gives it to a... puts a in a tie because Anakin shows up to defend Padme, kills Krennic, and the Death Troopers, but then turns to the dark side and kills Padme. So apparently Anakin wins this one. Tony Van Velzen gives it to Padme in her aggressive negotiations. Travis Simpson gives it to Padme. And then on Twitter, at JediJack13 gives it to Krennic. Damien, at DamonKreese1 gives it to Director Krennic. At Balls in Play gives it to Padme. Dewey the Mailman gives it to Krennic. At Lowry Neal gives it to Padme. At Jeff Fett gives it to Krennic. And we got two emails. Jeremy says, I'll go with Padme. Orson is a tool. And Patrick says, I give it to Krennic. We have Death Troopers as bodyguards. You learn a thing or two. However, Padme would get a couple of hits in. So that gives us a final Larian tally of 14 for Padme, 10 for Krennic, and 2 ties. What say you, Carl?
This is what I say, Jason.
What do you say?
Oh, man. Where's the swell?
Fun part.
Well, whatever. I'm trying to get Krennic's damn theme here. Where is it? Why can't I find it?
I don't know.
Here we go. Good enough. But anyway, I give it to Director Krennic simply because he has a theme. And it's an awesome theme at that. Okay, no, because that's obviously not how matchups are done here in the Wampa
Center.
It's based on who has cooler themes, because Padme has no theme. She has a love theme with Anakin, but she has no theme of her own. I think, Leia's the only female character to have her own lead, her own theme.
Rey now.
Rey, hello.
And Jin.
And Jin, hello.
And Ahsoka.
And Ahsoka, hello.
Hello. So Padme's the only female lead without a theme of her own.
Yeah, without a theme of her own. Oh, poor Padme. Actually, I do give it to Krennic, though, because, you know, Padme's whole life was brought up in politics, whereas Krennic, if you've read Catalyst, he was never a direct part of, like, the infantry part of the military, but he was always involved in military intelligence. And anybody in any sort of form of military, be it intelligence or not, gets basic training, gets brought up in the gears of war. And also, Krennic's blaster is so freaking dope. Like, it's you actually have to, like, load it up almost like a real life gun. So, like, that in and of itself shows that he knows how to build a gun. Like, he knows how to make something kind of powerful. His little shootout with Cassie in there, like, he essentially does take down Cassie, and he doesn't directly hit him, but he's, you know, he does pretty well. Yes, Padme does some impressive things as well, but she's always surrounded by bodyguards and Anakin. Like, kind of a big deal. I think in a one-on-one blaster fight, though, I definitely give it to Krennic. So I'm going with my boy Orson.
Ah, there you go.
Orson also sounds a little bit like Ovaltine, which is delicious. Not at all, actually. It sounds nothing like Ovaltine, but they both start with O.
Yeah, that is true. I'm going to give it to Padme here. I feel like she's always underestimated, and she lets everyone underestimate her. We saw this in The Phantom Menace. When she returns to Naboo, she decides it's time to fight back and take back her planet. Trade Federation completely underestimates her, and she, you know, helps lead the assault into Theed and takes it over rather effectively. Then, of course, throughout the Clone Wars and in Attack of the Clones, she goes up against the Separatist army and the droid army quite a few times and always ends up to come out on top. Yes, a lot of times she has Anakin there to help get her out of things, but Krennic is always also surrounded by his Death Troopers, too. So it's not like either of them are well known for being out on their own in combat situations. So... I think Padme is craftier and would get Krennic to underestimate her, and that would give her just enough edge to get out alive. Not necessarily all in one piece, but out alive.
I'll buy it.
So that gives us a final tally of 15 for Padme, 11 for Krennic, and 2 ties.
That's a lot closer than I was anticipating.
It was pretty close. I was excited about that. So yeah.
I thank the Twitter people because it was pretty heavily Padme on Facebook. So I'm glad Krennic got some more love, some well-deserved love. He seems like actually a pretty polarized villain too. There's a lot of people that hate him. I've really been learning. A lot of people really didn't like his character. Yeah, I've read a lot of negative things about him. They just thought he was like, you know, too cheesy, or you know, he just like he's too much of a lapdog. It's like, no, not at all. First off, he's not cheesy. All Star Wars villains are cheesy. Let's be honest. Grievous is the supreme of cheese. And you know, even Dooku's pretty cheesy. Like all Star Wars villains are a little cheesy. Again, that's what it means to be in Star Wars. But
yes,
yeah, I think he's a great character. He's the most unique Imperial officer we've ever had. So
yeah.
I think both back-to-back Star Wars movies have given us a new type of villain. Kylo Ren was a new type of villain, very much so. And now Krennic is, I mean, he's the exact opposite almost of Tarkin. You know, he's not quite as, you know, loudmouthed and aggressive as General Hux, but, you know, he certainly knows how to keep himself, you know, pinned up, but he's also not afraid to express himself. Yeah, still one of my favorite scenes in Rogue One is when he's like, "We stand here amidst my achievements, not yours."
Right.
I love that part. I love that he like, and I hate Tarkin too. Like he's probably like my most hated character or my most hated villain, which is good. Uh-huh. It's good. Villains should be hated.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, I love that part when Krennic's just not afraid to stand up to him.
It's great. It is great. So, yeah, no, Krennic is a great character. I don't understand why people wouldn't like him, at least somewhat. I mean, I can understand if he's not their favorite, not their cup of tea, whatever. But I don't understand if people think he's, like, terrible.
I mean, he's no Newt Gunray. I mean, I like Newt. So, and what about the queen? Has she signed the Trinity? Has she signed the treaty?
She has disappeared, my lord. One Naboo cruiser got to pass the blockade.
I'll let you do. Yeah.
I want that treaty signed.
It's impossible to locate. It's out of our range.
Not for the Sith. This is my apprentice, Darth Maul. He will find your lost ship.
This is getting out of hand. Now there are two of them.
We should not have made this bargain.
End scene.
End scene.
Oh, man. If you don't love Phantom Menace, I apologize because it's amazing.
We have way too much fun quoting it.
I love Newt Gunray and Runehako.
They cracked me up.
That was still like one of the best parts of Celebration Orlando last time when you, me, and Kyle were in the hotel. And each morning we'd get up and just start quoting like different parts of the movies, and we would just like ride it all the way out till Continental Breakfast. Jason, I love Continental Breakfast.
I know you do. I remember this.
I can't wait.
Quite vividly, actually.
Yeah, I can't wait for Continental Breakfast every morning in Orlando. Oh, it's going to be so good. All those eggs. Mm, yeah.
Yes, yes. We are both going to be at Star Wars Celebration. Both of us have purchased plane tickets. We have room reservations. So it's actually happening.
It is. We both got media badges again, which we're very excited about and feel very honored that we get that, you know, that we're still given that privilege.
Yes. Thank you, Star Wars Celebration, for that.
Yes. And certainly we are not unique. A lot of our friends that podcast have been given the same courtesy, but it's still a great thing to receive. Especially when you put all your eggs in that basket, like, you know, because the 4-day pass is sold out like within a couple of weeks. And I was like, I'm going to hold out for my media badge and hope that I get approved again. And luckily we did.
Right.
But
I think that happened last Celebration too. It like
did. Anaheim happened as well.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Anaheim happened. We're like, oh, 4-day passes are sold out. So we have no backup.
Right.
If this goes bad,
we got planes and a hotel. Hopefully we'll get in.
Right. Exactly.
Oh man. But, yeah, I'm so excited. So, we really hope, you know, obviously those of you who listen to the show and who are hopefully also able to attend, we're Jason and I are working on doing a meetup as well with the Larians. And so we can get an opportunity to meet some of you guys while you're there. More details to follow soon on that about what exactly we're going to be doing for a meetup. But we definitely encourage you, if you haven't already, head over to TeePublic and purchase yourself a Wampa's Lair t-shirt. Now, granted, that you know, might be difficult considering you're like, well, I'm saving just to go to the darn thing. Totally get it. But we would love it if any of you Larians that are able to come, if you're able to grab a Wampa's Lair t-shirt as well, like we're definitely doing a picture with everybody that's able to come to the meetup. Why would you want to wear a
Wampa's Lair? And if we see you walking around the convention floor in a Wampa's Lair t-shirt, we want our picture with you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And who would, you know, Star Wars, let's be real, Star Wars celebrations, it's the one thing that I've noticed is the one you really want to make sure you have a unique Star Wars t-shirt. You know, people like, it's fine, you know, whatever Star Wars t-shirt you get, but like it's the most, if the more original and unique your shirt is, the more people like respect you. It's kind of weird. So just think, if you have a Wampa's Lair shirt, people are gonna be like, whoa, what's that? And then you can proselytize for us and tell them about how great our show is.
exactly.
We're about as self-serving as Darth Sidious and Darth Maul.
Know what I'm saying? There you go.
Yeah, anyway, sorry,
but yeah, no, just don't show up in one of those red Millennium Falcon shirts everyone wore to Celebration Anaheim.
Yeah, but if that's all you got, it's all you got.
That's true.
You know, just don't show up naked. That'd be awkward.
That would be very awkward. So, only Jabba can get away with that, and just barely. So
yeah, that's true. And Chewbacca.
But he's got hair.
Yeah.
So it's almost like he's wearing clothes all over his body.
Right. What about Wicket? I love Wicket. Anyway, we're getting really sidetracked right now.
We are. We're like way off topic. We're not even close to the topic.
No. So we're just gonna hop into it. Again, yeah. like we were talking about at the top of the show, this episode is a continuation of what we were doing last episode, essentially doing some planet hopping. Each of the planets in the films where we go sequentially generally helps with the storytelling of the movies as well. So we're going to go back to A New Hope, going to go to Tatooine, which we've been to already twice in the prequels, three times in the prequels, very briefly in Revenge of the Sith. But the only movie that doesn't get Tatooine is Empire, and now Force Awakens.
And now Rogue One.
True. Yeah. I think it's fine, though. Like, the saga films is where it really matters, I think.
Right.
I really hope we go there in eight and or nine, even if it's just for something. Tatooine is like, it's the epicenter of the Star Wars saga in a way. So,
yeah,
but I get it. Like, don't go there just to go there. I get that. Sure. But it'd be great if they could work it into the story.
It would be.
But anyway, so we go here, you know, this is the first planet we see in A New Hope. And again, every time, like we talked about in the last episode, you know, Tatooine, every time we kind of go there, we're kind of introduced to a different aspect of it. And it does something different for the story. In A New Hope, again, it continues to be that what a desolate place this is. You know, the first thing 3PO comments on, and you know, it's a very, you know, dry, barren desert. But you know, what's neat is like it's kind of devoid of life, of any vibrant life. But what we do quickly realize is Tatooine is a place where everything that lives and everything that, you know, exists there is struggling to survive. It's a planet that's kind of hard to make it by on. And again, like just like Naboo for Phantom Menace kind of opens it up and mirrors the state of the galaxy, right? Like it's this beautiful, great place before things go bad. Tatooine kind of mirrors the story of the rebellion at this point. The rebellion itself, it's just like anything that's inhabiting on Tatooine. It's struggling to survive. It's struggling to stay alive in a very, you know, difficult setting.
Yeah.
So Tatooine is kind of this, like, you know, difficult, dangerous, well, not dangerous necessarily, but definitely a different, difficult place to live and find life. But it's also somewhat similar to its first use in Phantom Menace, which, again, though, it's kind of introduced as a home planet, a sanctuary planet, because it does provide safety for R2 and 3PO.
Yeah. And it's, of course, you know, the homestead for Luke. You know, if we're going to start looking at this at Luke's point of view, it's where he's at right now. It's home. It's not where he wants to be, but it's home. And I'm stealing a couple of lines here from Empire to help describe it. You know, it not only is it home for Luke, but it also represents, you know, the future, the excitement, the horizon that Luke is yearning for. And then we really get that, you know, in that scene where he's watching the twin sunset. But it's almost like Yoda was watching that part of A New Hope,
yeah,
and was thinking back to that when he was, you know, complaining about Luke and his lack of focus in Empire.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the fact that it is, again, a binary sun planet, it's, and, you know, I made this point kind of in the last episode, but Tatooine continues, especially in A New Hope, to represent a planet of light. You know, while it's definitely a harsh, difficult climate, it's also a place that's very bright and it's very light. And, you know, that twin sun moment, Tatooine does represent the promise of what can exist. And right, that's a great place to start the story, is it's a reminder that even in the midst of desolation, even in the midst of this desert, there is hope for life.
Yeah. It's kind of funny that now NASA is discovering that there actually exists a system of planets that orbit twin suns.
Yeah. Luke's out there, bro. Sorry, bro.
Lucas knew what he was talking about. This really did happen a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It's history.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why he keeps adjusting it, because he's discovering new evidence.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the special editions for you.
Right. There you go. And the Blu-rays, the blinking Ewoks. That was his last revelation.
Yeah. Yeah. they actually had eyelids that worked.
Yes. Yes. They needed to make that happen.
Yes, they did.
But the last thing I was going to say about Tatooine is, again, and this is somewhat similar to the way it's used in Phantom Menace, which makes sense because it's the start of our story. Tatooine also, again, it's a small, insignificant planet, mm-hmm, but from that place, the place where we would least expect it, comes a savior figure, right? Luke is not the chosen one, to use like Star Wars canon words, but he is another chosen one. He's not the chosen one, but he's a chosen one.
He is. He's the next one in this line to really be the one to make the difference, be the one that everything is going to turn around moving forward. And it's also the place where we gather the crew. You know, it's got all these little hidden away places, watering holes, you know, mirages, so to speak, with Obi-Wan, you know, and you gather your crew, it's the place where we strike out from.
Yeah.
And it's a solid foundation to move us into the beginning of the new adventure.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Tatooine is like the Bethlehem of scripture. You know, Bethlehem is, when we first go there, it's a small, tiny, little, insignificant town in Israel, but from it comes the great King David. And then eventually comes the great King Jesus. So, you know, again, I love that Lucas uses that theme in his portrayal of Tatooine. Tatooine is kind of this mythical place of insignificance, but out of that insignificance comes such greatness.
Right.
So again, that's just classic Lucas using, you know, great, great mythological themes.
Exactly.
Hey,
do you want to?
Yeah, let's. So it's the next each. So in the originals, we have, in a sense, three planets that we go to in each of these films. Mm-hmm. However, in A New Hope, we really only have two planets. So we are throwing in the Death Star. While it's not a planet, it is the size of a small moon.
Yes.
But the Death Star is, in a way, though, it is a planet. It's an imperial planet. If you think about it, it's man-made. And that's significant. Right. Where does and even if you think about like an Empire Strikes Back, all the settings for the Empire are on spaceships, right? Mm-hmm. Like their dink home base is man-made, right? Like they aren't necessarily, they're never really rooted in creation. They're never really rooted in natural life. They're rooted in their own sense of control and power, which again, that's a significant storytelling element that Lucas uses. I really like these Star Wars movies, man. I don't know if I've said that lately.
Yeah. The Death Star also, you know, is literally the engine of war. You know, it embodies the idea. It's the symbol of the Empire. It's their engine of war. It embodies the might and the power and the intimidation that the Empire wants to portray as it wants to wipe out the Rebel Alliance, as it wants to subjugate the galaxy at large. This is their power play. This is their I totally lost the words I was looking for, so I'm going to let you jump in.
Well, yeah, I mean, what stands out to me is, you know, we go to the Death Star, which is, you know, Tatooine is, it's a kind of a sandy, dusty planet. You know, I love sand. It gets everywhere.
I hate sand. It's coarse, rough, irritating, and it gets everywhere.
I love that line.
It's cheesy as all get out, but it's funny.
Yeah, well, put some cheese on my cracker then. So
that's what you need. You need a bunch of crackers when you go watch Attack of the Clones.
Yeah, I'm all about it.
Star Wars in general, I suppose. But
but what's interesting, anyway, though, is the Death Star is, it's very different from a place like Tatooine, which is very dirty and dusty. The Death Star is spotless and clean and sterile.
Sterile.
Right? Like, it's somewhat similar to, you know, Topoka City and Kamino in a way, right? And everything there, likewise, it's sterile and controlled. The Death Star is a very controlled environment. Everything looks the same. You know, every hallway looks exactly the same. All Imperial hallways look the same. You know, they're that quintessential Star Wars look that I love. But if you think about it, there's no uniqueness to it. That is the Empire, right? There's no sense of uniqueness. There's no sense of individuality. It's
all uniform.
Yeah, it's this collective Borg unit. Yeah. You know,
it's one reason why, you know, when we refer to the Empire, we don't necessarily refer to, well, those stormtroopers and the Imperial officers and the guys who are the gunners and all that stuff, unless you're super into the Empire, which I know many people are. But, you know, we tend to refer to the Empire in general, broad sweeping terms. And it's because they are all so uniform. They are all so interchangeable cogs in the system, in the apparatus that we have here. And that is by design. It's made to look impenetrable and made so that everyone is replaceable with someone else. And when you lose someone, you just stick another person in there and you keep moving. Whereas with the Rebels, you lose someone and that's a hole.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Like the Russian army in World War II, you know? That's how they fought a lot of their big battles, is they just kept throwing people at you because they were in the commander's eyes, they were replaceable.
Yeah.
And Russia's not the only army to have done that. China's done that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So, but anyway.
But.
Yeah, but that's what the Empire represents, is it's just, no, you're all just numbers, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and obviously the First Order continues that.
TK-421, why aren't you at your post?
FN-2187, who gave you permission to remove that helmet?
Exactly.
I believe Lady Brienne of Tarth did. That's her Game of Thrones character.
Okay. I figured.
But yeah, no, I mean, so again, you know, the Death Star also, it's a very dark and ominous space. And when we're in there, it represents this place of danger and captivity, right? I mean, so much of that story is about evading capture, evading being caught there. So the Death Star represents a place of imprisonment. So while Tatooine, what's so funny is, because you kind of brought this point up, and it was a great point, Jason, you know, that Tatooine in a way feels a little bit imprisoning to Luke, but there is still a great sense of hope there. The Death Star is literally a prison, you know, at least to the forces of good.
Right.
So, you know, we go from a place with potential to a place of, oh my God, potential imprisonment and death, you know?
Yeah.
The Death Star, at least from the eyes of the good guys, it's just a floating Alcatraz.
Pretty much.
But
floating Alcatraz that can blow planets out of the sky.
Yeah. Yeah.
No big deal.
Not to be trifled with.
No.
So yeah.
Yavin 4?
Yeah, we go from the Death Star to Yavin 4, which is, we don't explore a ton of yet. We don't explore a lot of Yavin 4, but when we do, we think about you, the Larians. Nothing rhymes with Larians except Larians. Don't be contrarians.
There you go.
Anyway, so yeah, we go to Yavin 4, which is, again, somewhat similar to Naboo, and Endor in the sense that it's a green planet. It's got, you know, vibrant life. You know, whenever we have outdoor shots, we can hear, you know, animal sounds. We hear the sounds of life happening on Yavin 4.
Right.
The thing that stands out to me first and foremost, though, is, you know, when the shots of like the Falcon flying in over the treetops and off in the distance, there always tends to be like a bit of a fog, a bit of a haze, which mm-hmm. I think is great because it really shows it's a hidden place, right? Like Yavin 4, again, it acts for our story as a sanctuary space. It's a place to hide out. And the planet itself looks that way. I mean, they're hidden in a jungle. You know, it's a place
in
that
temples, ancient temples in the jungle. It's a refuge.
Yes.
You know, it's a fortress, you know. And I like the fact that they're hidden in ancient temples because, you know, and they've got this new Death Star coming at them because it's almost kind of like representing the fact that this is kind of like the old guard. These are the people that, you know, want the way to go, you know, want things to go back the way they were. They want to bring back the old Republic. They don't want the Imperial Senate. They want the Republic Senate. They want the, you know, the democracy. They want not, you know, not the tyranny, that sort of thing, you know. So I like the fact that because they're in these ancient temples, it also gives the idea that this is the way things used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, and that was the next thing I was going to go with, Jason, is, you know, the fact that there is these ancient temples also indicates that it was once a place of belief, right? Like those temples, they don't just look like old, like, you know, government buildings. They look like worship places in a sense, right? Like they look like, I mean, they architecturally, they look very much like, you know, like a Mayan temple from, you know, mm-hmm. Central America. You know, so again, kudos to the design team for these movies, but you know, it's not just, you know, it's not just some random old building. It's specifically a place where they're still hiding that old belief too. Like that old belief still exists hidden right now because it's being suppressed, but it still is hidden out there. I love that, right? Like that the sanctuary's place is also a place that has in some deep way a sense of belief and spiritual belief in something greater.
Exactly.
And that's the place where, you know, our story takes us to show that, you know, the scariness that we just left on the Death Star, there is a counter to that.
Right, there is. And it is from that base, that refuge, that almost sacred place, you know.
Misa show you.
Come on, Misa show you. It is from that place that the rebels are able to strike from and really strike a significant blow against the Empire by destroying the Death Star. So, you know, it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
Mosey into Empire?
Let's mosey into Empire.
And Freezer took us off.
Yes, I like Hoth. Growing up in the snow makes you appreciate it. But
I've never grown up in the snow.
Well, I'm going to, you know, to me, Empire specifically, I don't know why, and it's not, I'm not saying this to the detriment of any of the other films, but to me, the three planets we go to in Empire really significantly add to the story. Like, they're really strongly mirroring where our story is. And we start that with Hoth. Hoth is this freezing cold isolated world that is really not meant for humans to live on,
right?
And you know, they're there hiding, you know, they're making an inhabitable place habitable for the sense of survival.
Yeah, it really is a reflection of the Rebel Alliance and our heroes in particular on the run.
Yes,
they have nowhere else to go. Yes. And so they're, you know, we basically get a planet of Antarctica, you know, in which to carve out a place that's somewhat, you know, habitable, somewhat livable, at least a place that they can exist and not just freeze to death. And it's also kind of symbolic because, you know, the rebels, after their attack on the Death Star and the retaliation of the Empire after that, they're left out in the cold.
Mm-hmm.
In a very metaphorical and now literal sense.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And, you know, and if you think about it, any hopes that they might have had of the Senate potentially coming to their aid in light of some, you know, the knowledge of the Death Star, that's all been squashed too, because we learn in A New Hope that the Imperial Senate has been disbanded, you know?
The Imperial Senate, the Emperor has, you know, disbanded the Imperial Senate.
Dissolved
the old, remnants of the old Republic have been completely swept away. There you go.
How will the Emperor maintain control without the bureaucracy?
The regional governors will now have direct control over their territories. Fear will keep the local systems in line. Fear of this battle station.
But what about the rebels and the Rogue One crew who stole the plans, and Captain Cassian Andor, who's by far the most attractive rebellion leader I've ever seen? Oh, sorry, those are my deleted scenes.
What?
But
what?
But, what? What? Excellent. But no, what was I going to say? But in Rogue One, though, we do get a sense, you know, when Mon Moth was like, let's get Galen because he can testify to the Senate about this. And even Tarkin, you know, when he's pissed at Krennic, is concerned, you know, if the Senate learns about this, you know, countless systems will flock to the rebellion.
Yes.
So, you know, that's a great point, Jason, that like when they do destroy the Death Star, it's this great high triumphant moment. And it's like, yes, look at Galaxy, look at what they had built. But it doesn't matter. You know, the Senate's not even there to help you anymore. So they are, like you put it, out in the cold.
Yep, pretty much. And, you know, you could imagine that sort of the way that people who were inspired to join the rebellion after the destruction of the Death Star might have felt when they got there and realized, oh, this isn't exactly what I signed up for.
Yeah. You know? I mean, it's the Valley Forge moment, in a sense, right? Like in the American Revolution, you know, that when Washington and his troops are just encamped in this winter place of Valley Forge, and tons of them desert because they're like, screw this. This isn't what I signed up for.
You can imagine there's some rebels deserting at this point, too.
Yeah. Well, and also notice, now granted, I don't think this was intentionally part of the story, but there doesn't seem to be anything but humans in Echo Base.
Right.
So debatably, you know, well, folks like the Mon Kyles, why aren't they there? You know, where are they?
It's too cold for them.
Yeah, right. Probably. Maybe that's quite possible that, you know, the main cell goes to Hoth, but maybe some of the other species, like, we can't hack it there, so we're just going to, you know, like, there doesn't seem to be the fleet there, like the rebel fleet that we hear referenced in Rogue One.
Right.
And then we see again at the end of Empire. But where was that fleet, you know, during Empire? I mean, it could have been there. We just didn't see it. But
No, you're probably right, though. This is probably, you know, a large portion of their ground forces are here on Hoth. Their fleet's probably mobile. Their fleet probably isn't stationed anywhere.
The fleet is mobile.
It's mobile. They're gypsies. They're, you know, they're just wandering the universe at this point.
Well, they're probably still mourning the loss of Admiral Raddus.
Well, I would.
I still am.
I know, exactly.
I don't know why I'm laughing. It's sad. Laughter's gypsies, the only
tramps
cure.
And thieves. They're a bunch of gypsies, tramps, and thieves out there.
But anyway, back down to Hoth.
I don't have anything else to say about Hoth. So.
Well, the only thing I was going to say is, you know, again, it's representative of where the story is. It's the rebel story is now frozen, right? Like at the end of A New Hope on Yavin 4, they have some sense of life there, but now they're just in survival mode. Hoth represents where the rebellion is now. They're in survival mode. Which is somewhat indicative to where they were at the beginning of A New Hope. You know, it's almost like they've done a 180. You know, Tatooine represented at the start of A New Hope, like this struggling rebellion trying to survive in this harsh climate. Now they're struggling to survive in this frozen place to try to stay hidden. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like they've taken on the necessary risks of living among the Wampas, because at least Wampas are easier to deal with than the Imperial fleet.
I still can't believe they left us behind here.
Kind of rude, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly.
You know who wouldn't have left us behind, Jason?
Who?
Admiral Raddus.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he's probably still out there. He's one with the Force right now and saying, you know, Jason and Carl, may the Force be with you.
Exactly.
Closes his eyes very peacefully. So,
and then anyway. When he opens them up again, there's the Devastator right in his face.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a trap! It's a trap!
Anyway. So we go from the freezing cold sanctuary of Hoth to my favorite planet in all of Star Wars, Dagobah. The
most disgusting planet in all of Star Wars, Dagobah.
I love Dagobah. And something...
Really?
Yeah, it's my favorite. I'm looking at my little picture that I bought from Fan... Well, it wasn't from Fan Days, but inspired by Fan Days. Well,
there you go.
Welcome to Dagobah, the land of magic. The land of Yoda. The land...
Where, the primordial soup.
Yes. That's a really good point, though. It really kind of is.
It is. No, it is a very primordial planet. It's a source of life in a way. And I give you crap for Dagobah all the time, I know. But
of it, a swamp, like, probably very humid planet. Yeah, I probably wouldn't love that. But
yeah.
Disgusting. But I love what it is for the story. So please continue with your great points.
But no, it is. It's very primordial in a sense. It's got a source of life. It's a place of beginnings in a sense. In many ways for Luke, as he begins a new chapter in this journey, and takes another step into an even larger part of this world. But no, it is. I'm not going to use up all my points quite yet because I've got one more important one, so I want to let you jump in on that. But
something, and again, this is, you know, George Lucas, it's poetry, you know, right? The Empire and Attack of the Clones in some ways line up, and in this middle act, Dagobah is very similar to Kamino in some regards. The fact that it is, again, it's a mysterious planet, right? Like Luke comes in, there's all this cloud cover, there's fog, there's mist everywhere. It's shrouded in mystery. The difference between this and Kamino, though, is Kamino is like it's a little bit more violent in a way, just with those torrential rains. It's very like it's very fake there. It's fake life. It's life, but it's controlled life.
Yeah.
Whereas Dagobah, like you said, it's primordial. You know, and it makes me think of, you know, the sorry, but I like the Bible. You know, in Genesis 1, like the idea that, you know, by the way, according to Scripture, God does not create from nothing. There was always something. But there was this primordial soup, essentially, that God then starts creating out of. That's kind of what Dagobah is. Dagobah is just like this primordial sense of life that so much can be drawn out of. And that's what happens for Luke there. I think, again, there's something, again, I'm just so drawn to that planet because of its sense of mystery. But really what works for me, what makes Dagobah come alive to me, though, is essentially Yoda and his theme music. And this is something I'm going to do in, you know, when we go to Bespin next. But the music we get for both of those planets are very interesting, right? Like Dagobah, and again, like I'm taking a little bit of this from David Collins from back in one of his Oxygen episodes when they were doing Empire, but... you know, you first see Dagobah and your first encounter on Dagobah is a dangerous thing, right? It's like this something from the deep comes up to swallow R2, right? Like it's
right.
Seems to be dangerous. But then as soon as we meet Yoda, the music, you know, again, it's that beautiful, magical, playful music. And that's what makes me like, you just settle right in, even though it looks inhospitable. It's this beautiful place of growth.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's almost – it's growth to an extent that it's almost overgrowth, you know, obviously. But life – there is so much life here that it's practically taken over the entire planet. There's no place for something as artificial as Kamino and controlled as Kamino to exist on a place like Dagobah. And I like the poetry, the comparison that we're making there. Because it is very opposite, but similar.
At least the same visually, thing. It's similar. But
it is.
But the content is different.
Yes.
Right? Under that mystery of Kamino is an alien race creating life, like controlling cloning, a cloning factory. Dagobah, right, under that shroud of mystery, is just like exorbitant organic life, just bursting. I mean, like everything has vines growing all over it. Like you said, it's like the life cannot be contained there.
No. No, it can't. So,
which is,
and I love the fact that's where we find Yoda.
Yeah. Well, to me, Dagobah is the perfect indicator of Yoda's character. It's Dagobah is this part of the story where we're being told to expect the unexpected, right? Like Dagobah, like Luke feels like immediately, like, this place, this isn't right. Like, no way this is where this some Jedi master is going to be. But we learn that's exactly where he is. So, you know, the movie here is telling us, you know, our story is taking us to kind of like this dark, kind of creepy planet, but it's a great place to be. You know, it's actually where a lot of growth happens. So, you know, it's a reminder to us in our story, like, to expect the unexpected, which is going to immediately be the case with Bespin. You know, we go to Dagobah with an expectation of this is not a good place. Actually, it is. It's a very good place. And now we're going to go to Bespin, which looks like a great place, but it's not a great place.
Right. Right, exactly. So let's just go to Cloud City. Let's go to Bespin.
You want to go to Bespin?
Yes.
Second favorite planet in Star Wars. Oh, man.
You have music, don't you?
I do, but I got to find what I actually want.
Okay. I'll go ahead and start then. Okay. You know, my description of Cloud City in general is it's almost like hell masquerading as heaven.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
So what? Oh,
were you going to say more?
Oh yeah. I was going to, you know, say, you know, and I really identify that because of the change in colors that we get from the very bright white, you know, colors of the upper city to the oranges and reds and blues that we get when we get down into the lower part of the city and the carbon freezing chamber and, you know, the torture chamber with just the red walls and doors and all that stuff. So, you know, and the music.
Torture chamber.
Mm-hmm.
You brought it up.
I did.
Let's talk about it. I'm just kidding.
And then, of course, the music.
Yeah,
which is almost a siren song.
Right, and that's what I'm trying to pull up here. And again, I never knew this without David W. Collins. But it says they're flying to the towards the city. All right, darn it. I meant to do this beforehand. Here we go. Thank you. Here it comes. So in case you missed that was, you know, there's some very high soprano notes being sung there. And, you know, again, we don't need to be told this or reminded of this, but of the genius that is John Williams.
Right.
But I will say I never knew this. I never would have picked up on this if it weren't for David Collins and Star Wars Oxygen. But, you know, those high soprano notes, they're the siren call, right? That from Greek mythology of these beautiful women that draw you in and then devour you.
So, exactly.
And that's, you know, what, that's
you can't
what
listen
is.
To them because their song is – it's magical and it's intoxicating and it draws you in and you can't escape it. Men can't escape it, I should say. The only reason Odysseus is able to hear the song and live is because he had his men tie him to the mast and keep him from getting off his ship. So,
right.
It's weird because it almost sounds like it should be like angelic.
Yeah.
Because we're going through the clouds, we're heading to the city in the clouds, you know. It's almost like heaven,
exactly.
You know, like Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem in heaven, you know, if you're reading Revelation. The idea is, and then, you know, but it's not angelic. It's not quite right.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and what's interesting too, you know, as I think about this, so something we talked about for Phantom Menace again was, you know, when we go back to Naboo in Phantom Menace, it's because we have to liberate it from the forces of machinery, the forces of evil. Mm-hmm. Cloud City is a paradise, but as we uncover who's now in control of it, that's right. Like that's Bespin Cloud City in and of itself is not an evil place, but it is made evil by that which comes to occupy it.
Right.
But what's interesting is right. Like, you know, you're absolutely right, Jason. It's kind of this slow descent into hell. But as we come into it, you know, everything's white and clear and clean, and like these soft, inviting oranges. And again, in the story, when we first come there, it's a sanctuary space. Again, you know, everything essentially in Empire Strikes Back is in a way a sanctuary space. Hoth is a sanctuary for the rebellion. Dagobah is a sanctuary for Luke as he continues his training. And Bespin is hopefully a sanctuary for the rest of our heroes as they're evading the, you know, the Imperial fleet. But Bespin's finally the place where they get caught, and it doesn't remain a sanctuary space. But as they come in, you know, it's this beautiful paradise like setting. Everything seems so great. Everything on the surface is wonderful. But as you go down to the core, you find out what is now in control of it is the Empire. And what does the Empire do? It corrodes, corrupts, and makes it empty. And that's what I just think of. Like the last place we really go to on Cloud City is that endless, what seems to be an endless pit that Luke falls into. And to me, that's like, what's at the heart of the Empire? Nothing. Soullessness, right? Like it's ultimately empty. And again, like to read a little bit, probably too into this, but Cloud City kind of represents like the superficiality of life. Like on the surface, everything looks beautiful and perfect, and inviting. But as you get to know it, as you get deeper into it, you recognize that it's actually quite empty and it's hollow. Yeah. And it's all you hear is that sound of wind, that empty wind that we hear as Luke falls into the endless pit. Right.
Yeah.
So,
one other thing I wanted to bring up about Bespin Cloud City, and you know, and obviously in the way that it's supposed to be inviting, and then it's everything is just turned on its head for the rebels when Vader shows up. I'm going to go back to the Odyssey in Greek mythology real quick. I'm going to go back to that. It's like when Odysseus and his men land on Circe's island, and Circe is, for those who don't know, is this witch goddess.
What's her name?
Circe. C-I-R-C-E.
That sounds like Circe, who is like a witch queen in Game of Thrones. So anyway.
Yeah, that's probably where they got it.
Yeah.
They go there. It's a beautiful island. It's gorgeous. There's lots of lush fruit and plants and all this stuff. And there's a scouting party that goes out, and they see this house, and they're invited in to come have dinner. And Circe brings them inside, and then with her witch powers, turns them all into pigs. And, you know, keeps them imprisoned there for a long time. And I forget exactly how they escape, but she's, you know, because they dared to invade her island, I suppose. But, you know, it's really kind of like that. You know, it's inviting, let's go to dinner and all this stuff. And then, well, not anymore. You know? So we get that idea both in Cloud City and here with Circe in ancient Greece. So.
Awesome point. Yeah.
I just like that. So.
Well.
I like the Odyssey.
Yeah, I do too.
It's one of my favorites.
Stuff. But you know, it's interesting too is in Empire as well, each of the planets in its own way has almost its own theme music, right? So we had Yoda's theme for Dagobah. You know, we have Lando's theme, which is kind of the Cloud City theme initially, right? It does. It's this light, fun, happy music. Somewhat similar to Yoda's in a way. But then gets even higher. Then it starts to come down a little bit. And then here we go. It swells to this like, uh-oh. No, please don't get up. No! Right, so like, Even Lando's theme, it starts really high and mighty, and then it comes down to this like really dangerous point, even musically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, anyway, I like to pretend to be Dave Collins every now and then. So, a boy.
John Williams is a genius.
Yes, he is.
Anyway, so,
shall we hop over to Return of the Jedi?
Yes, yes, we shall.
So we only get one new planet in Return of the Jedi.
We do.
So,
but first we go back to Tatooine.
We go back to Tatooine
because you know why not?
yes. But once again, we're getting a different facet of Tatooine. It's not the same Tatooine we saw in A New Hope or in Phantom Menace. It's actually most similar to the Tatooine we meet in Attack of the Clones.
Yeah.
It's dangerous.
The dangerous.
It's the dangerous planet. And, you know, what exists here are scary creatures. And more than anything, there are monsters living in the ground that will swallow you and slowly digest you for 1,000 years.
Yes.
Yes. So, you know, Tatooine in Return of the Jedi, it's not a home place anymore. It's a dangerous place. And it's a place of anxiety. That's to me, like, the whole time we're on Tatooine in Return of the Jedi, like, it's this sense of anxiety. And, you know, 3PO obviously does a great job of voicing that for us. But, you know, it's essentially, it's a place that needs to be escaped from. You know, Luke wanted to escape there in A New Hope just so he could have a fuller life. It's not because he's necessarily in danger. Here we need to escape from it because there is danger. And the planet itself is threatening to swallow our heroes.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm going to just real quick make this connection again that I've done before. You know, I talked about the Odyssey just a minute ago. In the Odyssey, you know, there's two things in Return of the Jedi that are very, very similar to events that happen in the Odyssey. We get the Rancor scene in Jabba's palace, which is very similar to when Odysseus and his men confront the Cyclops, you know, in his cave, and he eats a few of them. You know, it's very, very similar. And then, of course, the Sarlacc is the Whirlpool Cherubitus, I think is how that's pronounced. I could be completely mistaken on the pronunciation, but
it's pronounced Cheetos.
Yes. but there's a... They have to traverse. They've got some people pursuing them across the ocean. They have to traverse through these narrow crags across the whirlpool while this monster, this six-headed monster that lives in the cliffs above the whirlpool, picks off Odysseus and his men. You know, Odysseus's men as they try and get through. And it's definitely, you know, Jabba's sail barge and the Sarlacc. So, but I also want to look at Tatooine a little bit from Luke's perspective. Luke's returned home for the first time after becoming a Jedi. And like a prophet, a Jedi is never appreciated in his own home.
Yeah, good point.
So, yeah. Bringing a little bit of biblical stuff back here.
Well, even think of the first time Anakin returns to Tatooine is as a Jedi. Mm-hmm. Jedi, well, he's a Jedi Padawan, but and he's almost not welcome in a sense. Like Watto just wants to use him, and the Lars, they're just like, he's just an outsider. Maybe not so much from Kleeg, but definitely like Owen, like he's just an outsider. He's not really welcome there anymore, you know. And even his idea of like going to rescue his mother, like, you're dead, your mother's dead, son, accept it, right? Like his notion of his purpose there is misunderstood. It's not welcomed. And Luke is certainly not welcome there either. But like a prophet, he comes to bring the truth. He comes to bring the light, right? Like, I've always loved that shot where we first see Luke, right? Like the big door is coming up and pours all this light silhouetting Luke. Like, he's coming to bring the light, but the darkness cannot abide in the light. Therefore, it must be destroyed.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
So, yeah. So, you know, Tatooine here is a place where... In a sense, though, Luke kind of cleanses it in a way, you know, like
it's almost a testing place.
Yeah.
And Luke and our heroes pass.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah. It's the first time the heroes get to work together. You know, the last time our heroes in a cohesive group really worked together was A New Hope, and they were successful. And again, right. We've talked about this on previous shows, but yeah, this is the first time where the whole new group is working together and they're successful. But yeah, Luke, in a way though, this is just coming to me, but like Tatooine here, we see its corrupted side. We see its broken side, and Luke comes and cleanses that. Now, I'm not advocating violence to cleanse evil, but you know, mythologies do that, right? Like, it's the point of the storytelling. Luke comes and confronts the evil that exists here. So he has to purify it. He has to eradicate it. And that's what he does. So yeah, that's a great point. Tatooine is a proving ground here. And they succeed.
They do. And then they move on.
Yes. So, like, yes, our heroes go on to their fleet, but Luke does go back to Dagobah.
Yep. I didn't really have anything to mention really about Dagobah for Jedi, but I'm sure you had a thought or two.
I just have, yeah, a few simple things. Like, again, it still remains somewhat of a tranquil space. and one thing I noticed is it doesn't appear to be as misty and cloudy. Which I think is important, right? Like, when Luke first goes there on Dagobah, it's somewhat indicative of what's going on inside of him. Like, he's still very unclear of his purpose, his
right.
Who he's supposed to be. But when he lands successfully this time, and he's very close to what appears to maybe be the same very pool of water he crashed into last time. But this time, the water's very still and serene, right? Like, so it does kind of reflect where Luke is at this point of his story. It's not a tumultuous place for him upon arrival like it was in Empire. But again, it's a place where growth happens. And what the growth that happens here is the growth of truth, right? Like Luke finally has the whole story. Luke finally gets the entire truth unpacked here. And it's in a tranquil space, and you know, Luke is going to grow through this and take that back into our story.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's pretty much all I have to say about Dagobah for
Return of the Jedi. You're right. It is a much clearer space, and it's a much more tranquil space. And even the life and the wildlife doesn't seem quite as wild as it was back in Empire. So things are calm now, you know. And things are also almost in reverence and mourning a little bit for Yoda as he passes. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always loved that shot when Luke looks back and then the light goes out, in a sense, you know, the firelight. And I've always just wondered, like, is that the Force blowing it out? Is it just burn out on its own volition? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, again, just visually, it's just great storytelling. It's just like his light has gone out of that place.
Yeah.
But now he's everywhere, 'cause he's one with the Force.
Yay.
Yoda will always be with you.
He is one with the Obi-Wan. Force, and he is with me.
Yeah. Yes. So, by the way, did you notice? I think that's the only time Luke calls him Obi-Wan. Right? Does he ever call him Obi-Wan in A New Hope? I don't think he does. He calls him Ben in the vision on Hoth.
He says, you know, says he's a property of an Obi-Wan Kenobi.
But he does. But he's not calling him that, right? Like, he's not. Right. To him, that's two different people still.
Right.
But yeah, throughout the movie, he continues to address him as Ben. He addresses him as Ben in Empire. I don't think he doesn't address him by name when he's leaving Dagobah. But yeah, that's the first time I think he ever says Obi-Wan. Again, because it's like, I don't know, to me it's kind of cool because it just kind of connects him to the Fuller story, right? Like, that's his prequel name. Yeah. That's his Jedi name. Ben Kenobi is the exile on Tatooine's name.
And also shows the maturity of Luke.
Yeah.
He's not calling him by his nickname anymore.
Right. Right. Yeah. So let's go to the land of the Ewoks. What do you think?
I love Endor. It's a peaceful place. It's a, you know, it. There we go. It's a party place. It's
party place.
What it is.
Actually, you know what I realized? Sorry, this is.
What'd you realize?
This is a different version I have, but Spotify dropped all the like Ultimate Edition soundtracks. I don't know why, but they put they uploaded like all the old original soundtracks. If I could just get Spotify to open for me, my computer's like, no, I don't want to open another program. I'm getting too old for that.
getting too old for this sort of thing.
So anyway, I'll worry about that at another time. Let's just start talking about Endor.
All right. Well, Endor is, it's almost like, you know, the idea of counter scoring, which we got a little bit with in Rogue One with the track of, you know, your father would be proud. We talked about that with Riley a while back. Endor is almost counter scoring visually initially, because, you know, it's a very tranquil, peaceful looking place that's got the Empire infesting it. You know, they're walking around in their little black and white uniforms and everything, and then there's these, you know, big radar dishes sticking out of the trees and, you know, that sort of thing. It's it really is infested with the Empire at this point. But it is full of life. It's almost like just beyond your range of vision.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and again, part of like what kind of clicked for me as to why I even do a show, do shows like this was, to me, I feel like there is an inherent connection between Naboo and Endor. You know, right? Like Naboo is where we start our story, where there is flourishing natural life. And then we go to Endor. And again, it's this vibrant, flourishing green space full of life. And what's also great here, actually even dissimilar from Naboo, because you made a great point about this on the last episode, Jason, about how Naboo, initially does feel very vibrant and lifelike and flourishing. But we do realize pretty early on, though, that there's a tension between the two life forms here. Right. Like they are not really in harmony with each other. They, you know, they just ignore each other. But, you know, by the end of the movie, because of the infestation of the Trade Federation, they, you know, they regain that harmony. Endor, though, there's still harmony here, even though the Empire is infested. And what I mean by that is you look at the Ewoks and look where they live. They live in tree houses. Come on, who doesn't love that?
That's awesome.
And the thing about like that setting is the Ewoks show us what life can and should look like. It's about being in harmony with nature, right? Like so to me, what I was thinking about was how the tree forests of Endor, you know, where the Ewoks live, kind of counteract the super tall towers of Coruscant. Coruscant is man's attempt to become like God, whereas the Ewoks just live naturally in what God has already provided, and they are naturally closer to the heavens, right? So like man-made is building these structures to try to, you know, reach the heavens, whereas the Ewoks, they just use what's already there to reach the heavens. So again, it's more, it's just this natural part of life.
Yes. And Endor, like the Ewoks, they're unassuming yet full of surprises, you know? Yes. So, I like Endor. Endor's a place I'd like to just wander and explore for days on end. Camping.
You just got to go to the Redwoods.
Yeah, let's go camping.
Yes. Okay, here we go. Finally. Got the Ewok version.
There we go.
That is so much fun. I know what I'm working out to tomorrow. So good. I have not had that version of it since I had it on a cassette tape, like, 20 years ago when I taped it off of my cousin. And all the other versions, even like the old finale, like, it's just like the human voices. And in the movie, even in the, you know, before the special editions, it was human voices. But they had like this special release where it was the Ewok singing it. And I love, like, they're having so much fun. Again, as much as like Ewoks, you know, ended up getting crapped on and, you know, people liked him at the time. They're like, and even the cool older fans now are like, well, it was cool when I was a kid. So yeah, they're still cool now, but I recognize they're kind of stupid. Like, they're different, sure, but I love them. The Ewoks, like, they do really represent, you know, the harmony of life. And
they almost are the embodiment of the life force of Endor, in a sense, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah, exactly.
The white blood cells of Endor fighting back against the infestation, the infection of the Empire.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
So, as we continue to talk about the Ewoks, but you know, even Endor has a theme, the Parade of the Ewoks theme. I think Endor is just, it's the perfect planet to end the saga on. Yes, and this is George Lucas's saga. Like, he was not planning on doing it anymore. So again, we'll see what the planets do story-wise for us in the sequels, the sequel trilogy here. But, you know, Endor is, it's a return to the, you know, the way the galaxy originally was in Phantom Menace, right? It's a return to the natural order of things and life being in harmony with itself again.
Yeah.
So it's about
not only the life, but the Force. You know, Luke has destroyed the Sith, and now the Force is back in harmony and back in balance due to the sacrifice of Anakin.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, Endor brings us back full circle.
It does. It's beautiful that way.
It's
like George Lucas knew what he was doing.
He definitely knew what he was doing.
At least half the time.
Yes. yes.
All right. Well, this is fun.
This was fun. I love talking about this stuff. Especially with you.
Aw, shucks.
But so there you go. There you have it. There's our Star Wars saga planet analysis of again, I really do think, you know, these planets each, they add and enhance so much to the story. Every time we go to a different planet, it's because George Lucas is using that planet in its setting and its environment and its colors and it sounds to say something about where our story is.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. George Lucas, man, is he bright. He's one creative dude.
He's bright as a light, bright.
Good one.
Thanks.
Oh.
Anyway.
Oh, man.
I was reminded of Light Brights yesterday for some reason, so it's like, never mind. Anyway, before we start wrapping this up, Carl.
Yeah.
We're going to do a poll now.
Yes. Yeah. We've been away from. So we. A while back now. I don't even remember when we started it because, again,
it's before Rogue One.
It was before Rogue One, which is why it's been a while. But we were doing a poll we were asking you guys your favorite scene in each of the movies, and we were going backwards, starting with Force Awakens, and we've done Force Awakens and Return of the Jedi, so now we're to Empire Strikes Back. So we want you guys to let us know your favorite scene from The Empire Strikes Back.
Yes. Yes, we do. And we'll get that posted on our social media, and we want you to respond. And then one other thing we want you guys to let us know is if you're planning to go to Celebration.
Yes.
Because we'd love to see you there. And again, as we sort of said in a rambling sort of way at the beginning of the show, we are working on, you know, doing a meetup situation. As soon as we know more, you'll know. So we just got to work with coordinating things with some of our friends and other things. So maybe figure out what the schedule is. Hopefully they release that sooner rather than later.
Right. But regardless, it'll probably be either, I don't know about Thursday, but definitely probably Friday. Sometime after the big Last Jedi panel stuff, but you know, probably sometime either Thursday evening or Friday evening. We'll just pick a spot that's easy to find, and we'll all meet up. And whether it's, you know, at a restaurant, or probably won't be at a restaurant, but we will find a place. We will definitely let you all know where it's going to be, so that we can hopefully meet some of you guys. Just, you know, talk some Star Wars. And
yes,
I'd love to do a photo op with as many of you as can make it. So
yes, that would be fantastic. That would be awesome. I will not be at Celebration on Sunday. The way my flights worked out, I'm going to have to leave about 10 o'clock Sunday morning. So I'm not going to be there for Sunday. So we won't do anything big or major on Sunday, unfortunately. I will be there Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I'll have to leave Sunday, though. So it's just the way the flights worked out. Otherwise, I'd be paying about $100 more, and I'm not going to do that.
So it makes sense. But yeah, so we will definitely keep you guys posted about that.
Indeed. Carl, yeah. If people want to weigh in on our poll or let us know that there's going to be a celebration or talk to us about our topic, where can they do that?
Glad you asked, Jason. They can do it on... Ooh, whoops. A little too loud there. They can do it on Facebook, facebook.com/wampaslairpodcast. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/wampaslair. Shoot us an email at wampaslairpodcast@gmail.com. And as we've been kind of pushing, if you can help us out with our Patreon page, you know, we'll get $75 pledged both next month and the month of celebration. We will be doing live shows for our patrons each night of the convention.
Yes. Anything else?
No, I've had a great time touring the planets with you.
Yes. Thank you for joining us on this tour bus. Watch your hands and feet as you exit, and make sure you pick up your trash. And don't forget your Wookiee. Anyway, I think that'll wrap up this episode of the Wampa's Lair podcast. Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been episode number 221, Planet Telling, Part 2. For Carl, I'm Jason, and we will see you next time here in the Wampa's Lair.